had no idea. We're surprised. C.S. Lewis had his book Surprised by Joy. We shouldn't be surprised. Oh. So the context of what we're saying here is we're still at the tiptoeing, small steps forward stage when we don't have a proposal yet. We know the issue, we know the complexities of it, but we're saying here's part of it that we seem to be clear about. Here's some other parts that we need to work on some more, but we're beginning to fit pieces together. So coming to step five of our eight-step plan, when the group seems to have reached unity through the Spirit's leading, the clerk articulates this understanding. And here's where the clerk earns his or her pay. Actually, I've never heard of a clerk being paid. Something's wrong here. And I've seen clerks who just sort of do it. I don't know. I can't quite figure out if they are so completely in touch with God that it just comes to them and everybody understands that, or if they've kind of got in the role of, if I say it, that's what it is. Because I feel as clerk a little bit more tentative about it than that, than saying, this is what we have decided. And I tend to put it more in the form of a question. Could it be that this is the way that God would have us go? And to try that on as the group listens together. So I'm saying carefully and tentatively expresses the understanding of the way the group has been led. An option given here is that sometimes the clerk is at a loss. There's still some fuzziness. But has come to know that there are people in that group who may be ahead of him or her in that insight into the direction. And they would feel the freedom to say, Sue, are you being led in a way that you could express what you think the leading for the whole group is? And you better have a good relationship with Sue when you do that. They may say, what? but they could honestly say, no, I don't yet. And you could go from there. But sometimes we expect too much of ourselves as clerk, that we always are going to receive this message in full form, and it may not be that way. But this is still tentative. Still tentative. We have not got anything down on paper, probably, but together we are sharing the pieces and how they might fit together and beginning to say, this is it not the direction we are being led? The last bullet point under letter A is a way of putting this in maybe too simplistic a way, but thinking about traffic signals and that the first expression of the leading may elicit to some a caution light, and they may say, well, slow down here. Not sure we're there. Or a red light would be something really to be concerned about, saying, no, I don't think that's it. And we need to be tender with people who have that clarity that we're not there yet, or that first expression of the leading is not it. It's wonderful to have green lights when we say, yes. It's amazing. Yes, that's exactly where we are to go. And again, this is the challenging part of the process, where the clerk has to be very, very mindful of all of the nuances of the issue that have been brought forward. And trying them on orally to the point where when it's time to write the minute, those things will be brought in readily. Now, Roman numeral 6 is a part that, in my upbringing of being in countless business meetings and friend circles, until I got into some committees and groups of a broader range of friends, I hadn't seen the discipline and the exercise of writing the minute out fully before there was ever action taken. And I really came to like that process. And I use it as clerk unless it's something so painfully routine that it's really not necessary. The treasurer's report has been given. Are we ready to approve that report? That doesn't require that we read out the minute in advance. But anything with any complexity, let's see, one of the examples. Oh yeah, I was talking about our meeting approved the purchase of a van for the youth program, and I'm not sure we did this at the time, but a good clerk would have taken into account the issues that have been brought forward of what the insurance will allow in terms of who will drive it, because the whole point was that an adult without a commercial driver's license could drive it, the youth pastor could drive it himself to functions, and that was the point, and those things should have been right in the minute. Issues about stewards drawing up guidelines on how and when the van could be used. Could it be loaned out to another church? Could it be rented out to another group? Those things have to be in the minute. They really have to be there, because that's our anchor, our point to which we would return later for clarity on, okay, what's the answer to that question? And I see too many business meetings where this whole part of the process is bypassed. And just go right ahead and say, do we approve this? And the question is, what have we approved? And it's sort of where parliamentary procedure may have it a little better, because the motion that is seconded and maybe amended and discussed is there before the group. And you keep saying, is this the correct action? So in our yearly meeting, while I was clerking, we meet in a large auditorium, which is a terrible place to meet, really awful. But it's the one that will hold us all, and it's sometimes warm weather. I'm sure you don't think it gets hot in Western Oregon, but it's amazing how during yearly meeting sessions it can get very hot. So the air conditioning in this auditorium is, believe it or not, welcome and almost essential. So it's where we meet, and the clerks are at a table up in front, and there's a recording clerk, an assistant clerk, and a clerk, and usually on anything with any complexity, the clerk and the assistant would work together in writing that minute. And a lot of times in monthly meetings, I've seen the recording clerk just does the whole minutes like you would in a parliamentary procedure meeting. And the presiding clerk is never involved in that stage of writing and reading and getting approval of that minute. Now, just curious, in your monthly meetings, does the presiding clerk get involved in writing a minute before you take action? How many do it that way? Okay, I need to bear down on that point. Well, we don't, in our meetings, don't do it on everything, but we certainly do on the issues that have the need for clarity. And there are a couple of reasons why this is really important. Number one is, that's your reference point in the future. People would say, now what did we do? And you go back and it's all there. Every part of what you've done is in that minute. And the history of what brought you to that point is in that minute. And in our institute, we just take time some afternoon, get people into groups, and I give them an issue, and I say, okay, come up with all the facts out of your mind and invent something, and I want you to cover all of these points that I've talked to you about in that minute. And they do, and they do a great job, but it's, for most of them, it's a first-time process. They just don't think things, have not felt it needs to be that meticulous, but it really does. You know, let's say Marshalltown is at the point of that initial seeking clarity about, are they going to sell the meeting house and come out and build a new place? There are so many complexities involved in a decision that major that it has to be in that minute. Someone comes along later and says, now what? What was our timeline? Who is going to be responsible for these things that needed checking on? The answer is, it's in a minute. You go there. And you notice I'm using singular for minute. It's that particular point where action has been taken and it's recorded. And you have it. You know, there are people who do studies of Quaker history, and they've come to realize that Quaker process is pretty good on this point. And they go back and find the old minute books, and it just tells them a lot about what was happening that brought the meetings to that decision. So it's a historical record for people in the future, but in the not-so-distant future, for clarity in what's been done. There's another reason why this discipline is worthy of emphasis, in that it's your way of clarifying what you're actually doing. Now, a word of warning here. Nobody in this room, but some Quakers are really picky about wordsmithing. And do not let this happen if you're a clerk. It usually is not essential that the exact perfect word be used. And some people they love to debate grammar and style and things like that. And it's just not worth our time. But the essence of the action, the real issues involved, and how we're crafting a careful agreement among differing opinions needs to be there. And so the clerk's job is to say, does this minute reflect where we've been, where we started, where we've been, and where we are now? And if you don't have any other takeaways, I'm judging by the lack of raised hands on my question that needs some real thought. And you are monthly meeting clerks or stewards clerks or whatever, think hard about taking that back home and saying, are we willing to try this? Now turn to page 7, and you have 3 possible kinds of minutes, and you could probably come up with a 4th or 5th or 6th one. But some people have the idea the only right to minute when you're all done with things. But some things don't get done in one meeting. So there could be the final action minute, and it could be a minute that says, we're not going to do this. You say, well, why do you need a minute for that? To clarify that that's your action. And you go back to it and say, we decided not to get a youth band. It was the dumbest idea we'd ever come up with. And you'd never use quite those words, but that would be the essence of it. As a matter of fact, that's what I thought about the buying of the van, but a good clerk doesn't try to impose, do they? It can say we're not taking some action, or we are. Now, the second variation, the process minute, is when we're not ready to complete the action, and you say, well, you don't need a minute if you're not going to do anything. Oh, yes, you do. You need to say, these are parts of the discussion we want to capture. There are these issues we have found unity on, and we're going to agree on those, and then to identify all the steps in the process that need clarity. And there's some things that are, they just are complex enough to need months and months of time. And at every stage, when you conclude the discussion, you need a process minute. And you who are recording clerks, you may say, that's going to be a lot of work. No, it's not going to be your work. It's the group's work. Presiding clerk is the ally. They make sure the wording is right. And they say, the stewards are being asked to do this and this and this. And the youth committee is being asked to do this, and they will report back to whom or at when, and so we can refer back to that. It really is helpful in things that take a long time. I mentioned the Action Our Year meeting that took about 5 years or so. And along the way, there would have been process minutes that said, we're still seeking clarity, and we're turning to the elders or someone else for work on that. One of the questions that I'm trying to avoid here is the role of the pastor in meetings for business in a friend setting. And that's a tricky one. And above all, we dare not say, okay, anything difficult, we'll turn over to the pastor and they'll report back next time. But the other extreme that's unfortunate is if the pastor feels utterly powerless and helpless in a meeting for business and no one recognizes the expertise they bring to the issues at hand. Pastors who have adopted the sort of strong leader model from other movements have a tough time in all of this because they feel like they got to be the leader, the Moses. Everybody turns to Moses for the Lord's word. Well, guess what? We're not in Moses' time. And the insight that friends bring and sometimes mess up on is that the pastor is an active part of our leadership, but they are not fully in charge. And that's a tough servant role for pastors to understand that they don't have to make all the decisions. They are going to be involved in things with the elders and other groups along the way and be a part of an emerging leading as it comes forward. But in that ultimate meeting for business when action is taken, they do have the freedom to speak. Hopefully not in an emphatic, authoritarian sort of way that says, I know what's best and this is what we have to do. Boy, I hope pastors in your meeting are not in the habit of doing that, because the active participation in the emerging leading, but never needing to say or feeling the liberty to say, I'm pastor and this is what we're going to do. God has told me. God speaks to all of us. And a wonderful freeing process in that is that the pastor doesn't have to have all the answers. And they may come to the point where the meeting is ready to act and they just are, their stomach is churning and they're thinking, oh my, is this really of God? But they've expressed themselves, they're not hiding the concerns they have, but they're saying, I am going to trust God that this thing is right. And the concerns I have down the line can be dealt with. And I don't have to feel responsible for that. It's freedom. Because sometimes none of us has all the answers every time. The third option, preliminary action, is simply that, to say, we have discussed with it this and we have dealt with several things and we're not ready to act, but we're going to persist in this. We're not ready to drop it. And there is this thing that we're going to do next. Somewhere in the outline, I've talked about a listening meeting, which is not the same as a clearness committee. A clearness committee, in general usage, is a person or a couple going to a group that they recruit to listen together about some decision, some direction in their lives. A listening meeting would be the whole monthly meeting or the whole committee or group saying, guess what, we're stuck. We don't know how to deal with it, with the conflicting threads of the discussion here. And let's have a listening meeting where the rule is we're not going to act. We're not going to take any action in this meeting. We're simply going to listen together to God and see what emerges. And at the end of the time, we're not going to say, this is what we've decided. But we'll bring the results of our listening back into that other group and see where we go. And the case study I mentioned last night about the daycare center at the church in Seattle was the kind where they did that several times. And it was really important. And another case study in there is about a pastor being considering whether it was time, whether they were being led to go to another meeting as pastor. And the people were tense and struggling over it. And they had several listening meetings where people were allowed to come and share their grieving. And they didn't want them to leave. And that's a good thing for a pastoral couple or a pastor to know that people still love them and want them to stay, but have to ultimately say, oh man, it's no good. God is leading them and I can't stop them. And that was done in several listening meetings where the point people were ready to say, go. We love you. We love God. God is calling you and we can't stop it. And that's okay. So listening meetings come in there. All right, point number 7. Don't leave this part out, or you don't have an 8-step plan. You have a 7-step plan, and that, no, that's no good. The minute is read to the group to confirm that it's captured both the spirit and the details of the decision. Now, it'd be nice if our work was so fully formed that just the words were given to us by God and where no one would question any part of that minute. But I'm here to tell you that that's probably not going to happen every time. And so the clerks just say, that's okay. Let's hear people. And as long as it's not wordsmithing, people being grammarians, we can say, yeah, you've suggested a better way to put that. That your words really do capture what the way we've been led. And it's a little like what happens in parliament procedure, where if you do it carefully by the book, there's a motion to amend and a second and a discussion of the amendment, and then you have a new amended motion. And this is kind of what's happening, that we do change the wording. They're not the Ten Commandments on tablets of stone. It is our understanding at the moment, and we modify it and say, are we united around that? Do we approve that change? Good. It's there. It's been an improvement. And I think here the listening silence comes in because we're on the verge of a decision that may represent months, even years, of work and struggle, and you can't hurry it up. It's saying, are we united on this? And it's not, are we united on what? Are we united on this minute that's in people's hands? Or it's up on the screen. We see it. We prayed about it. We're saying, God, is this it? Yes. Well, we thought we'd never get there, but we're coming to point 8 of this 8-step plan. And this is a fun one. And the place where we our system really breaks down, can break down. Oh, by the way, D is actually the top of page 8. I don't want to leave that one out because I've been in Quaker meetings where the clerk reads the minute and just pauses and then says, and then goes right ahead. It's an assumed approval by silence. And I don't know if I am misreading the book of Quaker process, but I think the right thing to do is to say, do we approve at the point we're ready to do that? Now, there's some problems with that. This other method, they just assume that if we don't approve, we would say, well, I'm not so sure that we're ready yet at all to go ahead, or that this is, we've quite got that minute crafted right. But in the case that there is approval, just having silence with no response bothers me. I like to have oral approval. And when people have never been in a friend's business meeting and people are saying, I approve, they don't know quite what's going on. And they're thinking, is that a vote or what is that? I someone who is very familiar with Friends business process in England, and I've never been, been in England only a little bit. I've never been in a business meeting among friends in England. And they said, at least in Britain, you're in a meeting session, when they have an action, the response is, hope so. I heard that and thought, what? You're supposed to say approved. Hope so. And I don't know if that's utter humility. Like, we've listened to God, we trust this is right, and we're not 100% sure, but we sure hope it works out. So, anybody ever heard that one? Oh, yeah. Colin, have you been there? Do they really do that? Oh. Well, those people are crazy over there anyway. Actually, I have a little game that's a package-produced little game that's not quite about Quaker business process, but it's about Quaker nominating processes. And has anybody seen that one? Oh, it's dealing with all the excuses or reasons that people decline nominations. And you have cards for the different options, and you play them at different times. We tried it one time, and we just gave up. It was just totally beyond us. And it didn't seem like any fun at all, because there's the painfulness of having been on a nominating committee. You go to people, and you say, well, oh my, I think I may need cataract surgery sometime. Okay. Yeah, and I've got grandkids. Okay. Well, anyway, that if you're really desperate for a game to play, I'll loan you mine. So, the step eight is the one about what you do after there's been agreement. Now, I said one of the case studies in this book is a case where there was clarity, there was action taken, it was all clear, but there was a later leading, and they ultimately changed it. I'm not talking about that, where it's done in good order. This is about the kibitzing that happens after the action. This is the parking lot discussion and all the behind-the-scenes kind of thing that can happen. And here's the rule. And here the clerks can be really emphatic. If it's been a problem in your meeting, it's to say, if you were not a participant in that meeting, you cannot second-guess what God has done in bringing the meeting to unity on action. You cannot. Now, there's no authorities. You can't arrest people for breaking the rule. Hard to enforce, but you can be as emphatic as you know how. You know what? We announced the meeting ahead of time. Everybody knew what was going to happen. We welcomed participation in the meeting. And if someone was out of town on business, okay. They might have contacted the clerk and said, could you hold that one over? I really have concerns. I want to pray. But if they don't do that, if they just were playing golf with their buddies and they come and say, well, I wasn't there. I didn't have a voice in that. I don't think we should have done that. That's a violation of the rule. That you trust God for the certainty, that sort of the tentative certainty that God has led. And you celebrate that, and you do not second-guess it. Not in the parking lot afterwards, not when you're talking to people. And if you're looking for them, you can usually find people that would be sort of the naysayers, and you could go to them and say, you know what? The monthly meeting decided to buy a van for the youth program. Don't you think that's a dumb idea? And you just know those people are going to say, yeah, that was a dumb idea. I wasn't there either, and how could they have acted without me being there? Well, you got to be there. It is a system that requires participation, and you can't be the one to say that action had no validity because I did not have a voice in it. And if I seem a little touchy on this point, I just have seen those things where it's just erodes the strength of the meeting if people are saying, well, and especially this second bullet point. I was in a meeting, but I could see the direction things were going, so I didn't want to say anything. I think it was a bad decision. Now that's a real rule violation. Okay? You were there. And some people have, you know, they have their antenna out and they say, well, this seems to be the way it's going. And I don't want to be the one to upset this process. And they're going to move ahead and they're going to act. Yeah. I'm going to get to that next on the section on differences. There are mechanisms by which we can acknowledge that some people are not ultimately in unity. At one of the colleges I worked at, in the faculty business meetings, I'm not going to say what college, but it was in the Midwest, so any of you could figure that out. There were people. The mechanism is called standing aside. On every action the faculty took, they stood aside. And sometimes they said, I want to be recorded as standing aside. And that was nuts. You know, it was like a voting system. And they were always voting no. And our challenge, and I'll get to it a little bit in the outline, is to acknowledge that some people really struggle with being in unity with the meeting. And they abuse, the main abuse of Quaker discernment is that you do not have a recorded vote that gives explicit voice to those who are not in agreement. And the related misunderstanding is the confusion of unity and unanimity. They think, and when you call it a consensus system, that's sort of what it is. The consensus is you don't act unless you're unanimous. And that's not our system. And we won't be able to get into all the understandings of that today, but our system is hearing God's voice, and it's sort of like a vote. If it were a vote, God has 51% of the votes. That the only thing that matters is, have we heard God together? And my own private views of what we should have done have been set aside in favor of the leading of God. And the abuse of it is to say, subconsciously, people wouldn't admit this, but they would say, if I am opposed, this group is not going to act. And a good clerk and a good meeting will be able to understand that we've heard that sister or brother. We've incorporated their ideas into the process. They are still not in agreement, and we are going ahead. And it isn't necessary or automatic that you put it off to another meeting simply because there's that voice. But I'll return to that point. But it is very much at the core of the difficulty of our process. And it's sort of why the gentleman from Caldwell, Idaho, that I talked about last night said, we tried that, it didn't work. They just found themselves locked up by some of the voices that felt greatly empowered in a perverse sort of way to be able to say, if I'm against it, they're not going to do it. And that is not necessarily true. Okay, let's go ahead. Seemed like there was one. Do this one because it's sort of where our meeting is. How do we deal with a congregation where there are more non-Quaker background than Quaker background members? Our rural meeting was established as a more of a Baptist church than anything else. It was really a community church, and my grandfather was one of the founders. And the year I was born, the church called a pastor who was a friend's pastor, and he said, fair warning, if I come, I may recommend that you affiliate with the yearly meeting and become a friend's church. So if you're not, he wasn't making an ultimatum, but he said I think it would be a strengthening thing for the church, and that's what they did. So I am technically a birthright Quaker, but since that's a matter of pride for some people, I'm not going to say that. But they took the action in July, and I was born in November. So technically a birthright Quaker, but not to be proud of. Anyway, how to deal with a congregation where more non-Quaker background than Quaker background members? Well, sell the book to them. Say, you're not going to join our meeting until you've passed the test in Quaker process. But actually, we do have lots of folks in our meeting that, and I think if there are many things that people can get annoyed with in friends' churches. And this is one of them. And it's just a learning curve. But we have those people who come to meetings. They sometimes are more listening than speaking out, and they're carefully observing. And if I do my job and we do our job together, they will be drawn into the system and say, this is wonderful. We don't have to have those 60-40 splits, and we go right ahead and do it, and the 40% are angry for years to come about that kind of division. And they haven't seen that anywhere, and they generally like it. But there are parts of it that are hard for them. Good membership classes will cover discernment. Sometimes we're guilty of this too, compressing our membership class into 1 hour. Don't do that. You know, elders should be designing a process for people who are ready to unite as members and not get in a rush. Give them some reading, do some classes, let them bring up their heart issues, and make sure they ask, now, how is this? I've heard that you don't vote in your meetings for business. How could you do that? Let them ask that. Make sure they understand that it could be a mystery to them, but it could be a great joy, and they could go away saying, we actually heard God in that meeting. That's amazing. Never had that anywhere I've been. So welcome that those folks, because they can really get hooked or they can really struggle with it. It's a good thing to be aware of. I'll take one more now, and then we'll go ahead to the next section. What do we do when our differences seem to be mostly the result of different personality styles? Well, that does segue us into the section on differences in your handout. I think sometimes we give too much weight to the role of our personalities in our differences, and it's usually more than personalities. We obviously are complex and wonderful human beings, and our personalities do shape who we are. I'm one of those weird introverts who sometimes is involved up front in leadership roles, and so I'm an introvert functioning like an extrovert, and that probably affects how I function in groups. But there are a lot of those animals around, in case you hadn't noticed. And so I think being mindful of people's personality without feeling like it's an obstacle to the group finding unity, to welcome the different ways we think. You know, the genuine extrovert who just is wonderfully energized by functioning in groups and being with people and meeting new people, which is a harder thing for me, they can contribute so much. But I think the one of the things a clerk can do is to know people. In our yearly meeting sessions with hundreds of people in a room, this is impossible almost. But in a typical monthly meeting, it's a finite number of people, and you've got your old-timers and your newcomers and your introverts and your extroverts and your crazy people and all of these things. And part of what you are authorized to do as clerk is to say, Bill, we haven't heard from you on this issue yet. Is God saying something to you that you could share with the group? The first time you do that, people will say, what? You're supposed to allow them to speak if they want to. Well, no. You can call on people. And partly by knowing them and them knowing and trusting you, that they will realize you wouldn't do that unless you were led to do it. And that probably it is God nudging them to share what's on their heart. So you're taking into account their reticent personality and saying, I think we need to hear from you on this. Now, the people who are on the other end of the spectrum and are the first ones to speak always, sometimes you need to deal with that out of the meeting and say, you know, you really contributed a lot to our meeting, but I think there are times when probably you ought to wait and just trust that God will speak through other people and give others a chance to participate. You don't have to speak to every issue. And they may get angry at you, but it really hurts group process if someone dominates. And if you have a number of people wanting to speak, you as clerk have some control over that. You can call on the other ones other than that person who's always the first to speak. So personality shapes who we are. I think spirituality is probably more important than personality in this whole wonderful mix of how God is speaking, because you have the saints among you, the people around whom you just are in awe of the depth of their spirituality and how much you know that they're hearing from God. And those are the ones you want to call on and maybe warn them ahead of time. You know, Sue, I may call on you sometime when I sense that you have something that God is saying to you. Don't be alarmed. You can be mad at me if you want to, and you can pass. The person can say, no, I don't think I have anything to bring right now. Thank you. But that's being cognizant of both personality and spirituality. Let's go ahead with the section on dealing with differences. Ron, you're my timekeeper. Do I have until when? You said 11:15, didn't you? Oh. Yeah, we will finish. Trust me. Are you next again? Do you follow me again? Going? Lloyd does. Okay. When I see that really nervous look in your eye that I'm stealing your time, I'll stop. Dealing with differences in group discernment, this is the tough part. I remember one of our institutes, people kept asking about this throughout the time, and I kept saying, we're going to get to that, we're going to get to that. And we didn't actually end up having very much time to get to it, and they were upset at me. So I worked for a number of years as director of a peace studies program, and a lot of the peacemaking we worked on involved groups and churches, not just global peacemaking. And that's where the real expressed need was within our yearly meeting and other churches nearby. So the more I worked in that area, the more I realized how challenging it can be. And I remember being called to go and help as a team of peacemakers in a church, and I sort of felt like it was like people that had filed for divorce going to the pastor and saying, we need marriage counseling, could you help us? And the pastor should say, no. You waited too long. No, they wouldn't say that. They would say, well, I can pray with you, but boy, we needed to be working on this years ago. And that's sort of the way with the church. When they're ready for the ER instead of the peacemaking team, you come in and you try things and it just seems impossible. But conflict, one of the biggest misunderstandings of the whole Quaker peace witness and any of the other so-called peace churches is that means you're exempt from conflict within the church. And that's hogwash. I don't know if they say that in Iowa, but it's nonsense. God made us as human beings, and we're going to have differences with each other, and they are going to happen in the church. And having a strong witness for peace does not exempt us from those differences. The question is not whether we have conflict, but it's how we deal with it. And people will say, you know, people love to see the exceptions to the situation. and they'll hear about the Quakers are fighting again over in this church. And, well, men, those people, they're not peacemakers whatsoever. They love to see hypocrisy or inconsistency. And we're too ready to give them ammunition for that. But conflict is a part of being human. It's a part of our functioning in groups. And actually, I have to keep telling myself this because I was a classic conflict avoider. And it was a funny person to be called into a peace studies program, but I really didn't like to confront people about conflict or deal with them. And I've gotten better at it. But at the top of page 9, one of the things the handout says, I'm sorry if we don't have enough of these for everybody, but the phrase conflict resolution I tried to get rid of while I was working in conflict issues and conflict management, which is a term I prefer. Managing conflict means you accept it as reality and part of your group. It's just there. And the question is, how are we going to manage it so that it actually strengthens the group and builds up the body of Christ? And resolution, to me, sort of sounds like resolving. You know, let's get people together, let's have them talk to each other, and they'll shake hands and they'll go away and the conflict will be gone. We've got to get rid of it. In a global context, if we can just get people to the bargaining table, they can draw up an agreement, they can have a treaty, and the conflict is done, and we can go home, and everything's fine. Well, you can see by exaggerating a little bit the problem in that. That it's how we work with it and let it work through us that actually strengthens the group. And I was talking last night about the text in Acts 15, which just deserves to be, it should be a page in your Bible that's worn out, where you've underlined and you look back at that and say, oh man. Well, in fact, happen to have it open. You know, and the phrase that I mentioned last night was, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to do this thing that God had led in a surprising way, with people from absolute opposite commitments going into that meeting. They were absolutely, it was no way for both sides to be fully valued and considered. No human way, but God had a way. And I also like the part at the end of the chapter. Don't read the whole chapter, because the heading in my Bible on the next section right after this says, disagreement between Paul and Barnabas. And you think, what? Where were you in Jerusalem? So you had an argument right off. Well, that's part of it. It didn't ever go away. But okay, they got back to Antioch and they read the minute. It doesn't say in my Bible there was a minute, but that's what it was. It was a great minute. It was fabulous. If you need an example, read that one. The people read it, were glad for its encouraging message. Judas and Silas, who themselves were prophets, said much to encourage and strengthen the brothers. They were the carriers of the minute. They didn't just FedEx it out there or fax it or whatever. They took it, said, here, we'll stand before you and read this, and then you listen to God and see if it deals with the situation. They knew very well that people out of Antioch would say, wow, they did that in Jerusalem? That is amazing. How could that have been? We were sure they were going to come down hard on us and say, you cannot do this anymore. God has spoken. And the miracle of it was, they said, there is a way forward. And they, it's an understatement. They were glad for its encouraging message. They weren't just glad. They were uproariously glad. They were jumping and shouting, this is so cool. After spending some time there, they probably were there days praising the Lord. They were sent off by the brothers with a blessing of peace. The Judas and Silas were sent back to Jerusalem to return to those who had sent them. And they said, tell them thank you. Tell them thank you to God. Because you people have really heard God and done something you never intended to do. Wow, that's the power of that text. So, Roman number 3, in the section on differences, if differences are dealt with openly and constructively throughout the process, the chance with an awkward impasse at the end of the process is minimized. The problem is if you let yourself get caught off guard as clerk, you have no idea that somebody felt so strongly at that point. Still, after you'd gone through all of that, there were concerns that had not been expressed. Now, the problem isn't just with the clerk. Remember at the end, I said this is such in clerking and membering. And this is where the members have to come forward. And it's breaking a rule if you have a concern about an issue at hand and it's not come forward. And the clerk, if they haven't sensed it, are not doing their job. You do not wait till the very end to deal with those differences. If they are tied into the whole process of crafting the minute itself can say, there are some among us who are uneasy about this action. But we sense that they're willing for us to go forward, and they will be in prayer for the group as we implement that. See what that's done? That's given respect to those voices that really are not there yet. And they're saying, oh, okay, they've heard me. That's all I had really needed. I needed to be heard. That's our humanness. We need to hear from God, but we need people to hear us. And the minute can say, there is wondering about this. There's uneasiness. And we acknowledge that, and we will watch it. That minute of that multi-year decision in Northwest Year to me was filled with that kind of stuff. That said, there are those who are deeply concerned. And out of great tenderness toward them, these are the checkpoints we're going to build in. If these things start happening, we're going to come back and revisit this. We are not sure it will work as we hope. We were willing to come back, and those folks heard that, and the minute was approved. Now, there could have been the parking lot conversations in that case still, but it was what made it possible for us to move forward. So, throughout the process, we have taken into account the concerns, and when it's clear that it's not time to act, we have postponed action. We said, we don't need to do this today. You know what? A lot of the things that we think have to be acted on right now don't. There are only a few things. You know the sales tactic that says, we've got this deal on today, and if you sign up today, then you'll get this great deal, and it's not available next week. And I say, turn your back on a deal like that. They're putting pressure on you. And so don't let people artificially create a necessity for action that's not of the Lord. But in this case, we have acted. We have built into the minutes, the minute, the things that need to be there. And Roman number 4 is, at any point, we can say, this will be carried over. We will be in prayer, we will have listening meetings, we will contact people individually. The clerk may have conversations with some of the most concerned voices and saying, help me understand. You are really exercised about this possible action, and I want to understand more what's in your heart about that. And that can do wonders for the people who are sometimes saying, they're not hearing me. And some special hearing sometimes can help a lot. So Roman numeral 5, an effective clerk is dealing with those things, is testing possible steps forward, and this is where they really do earn their pay. Now, Roman numeral 6, last page 11. The most difficult stage of the process is helping members with differences consider a step which does not disrupt the unity of the group. Now, there are any number of phrases that are used for this. I've just picked two. And the first one is the hardest one. And I put it, standing in the way of. Have any of you ever been in a friends business meeting where someone at the very end has said, I cannot unite with this, and my word from God is that we must not do this? Have any of you been in that situation? Okay. Did you have the temptation to want to go punch him in the nose? I'm looking at you, Ron. No, we don't punch people in the noses. Here's where our whole humanness comes in, and that there may be stubbornness involved. There may be people who have been heard, but they want to win. Their mentality is winning. If this group acts in a way contrary to my input and my convictions, I've lost. And you've got to get the win-lose mentality out of this process somehow, but you've got to take it into account still. Standing in the way of could be God's way of saying, late in the process, you've got to speak, you've got to do it with conviction, you've got to do it with tenderness, no haranguing people for what they're about to do, that they're being sinful, but to say, my understanding, my leading is that we are not to do this. And it hurts me because I have been heard. Now, if they say that without ever having spoken before, they've broken the rules. They must not do that. And you've got to educate your people. You do not wait till the 11th hour to say, I am going to stand in the way of this. But if they have been heard throughout, and people, and it has not gone the way they are sure it should go. Wow, that's hard for a clerk. I've never been in a situation as a clerk to have that situation. I don't know what I'd do. Would I really hear the voice of the prophet? The Old Testament is full of prophets. Do you know what the prophetic role was? To be in a minority, to be the lonely one. Jeremiah and other prophets were constantly speaking against the way everything was going. And what a terrible role to have. And probably for the genuine prophet, it hurts them immensely to have to be in that situation of saying, yes, I know you've heard me, and I know we've labored with this, and I know we've done things as we should, but please hear me now. My leading is that we're not to do this. Yeah, Ron.
Unfortunately, in my career, I think I've come to a place where if you've done this enough, you begin to recognize a pattern that an individual would historically and traditionally do that. And in fact, impede the entire process. And if they're doing it consistently, time after time after time, you have to take that into consideration. And how do you deal with it?
It's inconceivable to me that on every issue that a person would come to that point of saying, my leading is, this is not of God. And in most cases where it is human stubbornness or abusing the system, they really can't honestly frame it that way. And the clerk has to find a way to say, friends, we've heard this friend who really feels we should not go ahead. And we must pray about this. We must be careful because we love that person. We do not want them to feel that they've not been heard. My sense as a clerk is that God has spoken to us and we are to move forward. And that's why it's not unanimity. We do not have to be unanimous. Some people have said one person can stop the action of a friend's business meeting. And they can. But it has to be framed this way. That they are Jeremiah. The lonely voice saying, please hear me. And as much as I know how, I feel like I'm speaking God's message at this point. And the stubborn voices usually can't honestly do that. It really is a habit that they've gotten into. And it's wonderfully empowering for some people to figure our system out and say, what? I can stop this whole group and they'll have to do it my way. No. We're doing it God's way. And that will, I think it takes a real eldering outside the business meetings. And again, I've not really had anybody like that. I think I understand what has to be done, but one of these days I'll have to put it to the test. Any other comment on that point? Colin, are you going to say something? Disempowers, and maybe not the best word there, it empowers them by acknowledging that they strongly prefer blue carpet. It's a theological issue for them. Or our youth van, we bought a Chevrolet, and everybody knows that Chevrolets are no good. My gracious sakes. But a good minute has acknowledged that there are differences of opinion. And you can use that phrase, differences of opinion. We're all entitled to opinions, but I'm not going to stop action because I prefer Fords, for goodness sakes. And it allows some flexibility. And maybe we said that the stewards will check again on whether it's a better vehicle for our needs. But barring new information, this is what we're going to do. It's one person's preference is another person's conviction, though. And we have to be careful about that. But colors of carpet and things like that are not of conviction. Yes? That's why there's so many caveats to this. If the clerk has been careless along the way, and knowing the kind of people who most likely, who maybe are the habitual standers in the way of, that you need to draw them out ahead of time. You need to talk to them ahead and now say to them, do you have any strong feelings on this issue? I want to make sure they get expressed. Please, please don't wait until the end. So it's sort of heading off that roadblock by being proactive. Clerks have a lot of power. They don't have any power, really, but they can be empowered to prevent the showdown at the end of the process. That's so painful. And it must be hard for people or new friends to come along and think, what did they just do? That person objected, so they're not going to act. Yes.
I'm thinking of an instance where the real core is on board with something, and the silver becomes the church core by the church, and everyone showed up to take this issue.
None of us will admit to being weighty friends, will we? We're not talking about what the scales say here, but it is a big temptation. Any meeting has weighty friends in it. If you don't know the expression, it simply means that they have wisdom spiritual strength, insights, and so they often can see to the heart of a matter and point out the real questions that we need to face. Now, that's putting it in a positive way. The negative way would be they're used to throwing their weight around. And it's a prideful thing. It's an unfortunate thing. You know, we have people in our meeting who have been members of our meeting all their lives. You know, I was a member when I was old enough to become an active member, but I've lived away from there a lot in intervals, so I'm not really a weighty friend there compared with some. But that's a responsibility, not a privilege. It's something to be very humble about and be careful about. And that's where a proactive clerk, if they see a discussion proceeding, one that's going over several meetings, they will go to those folks and say, you know what? We haven't heard from you on this question. Are you hearing God's voice on this issue? Or even during something that's handled in one meeting, you can call on them so that they do not. Throwing your weight around is doing the sort of pseudo-prophet role, saying at the end of things, well, friends, it seems like this is going to pass, but I have something that I need to say, and I'm really uncomfortable with this. Could be of the Lord. It could be just that prideful thing of, I'm used to having everything go my way. And that's not all right. I think the humility that tempers our wisdom is to say, all of the important things have been said. We have heard from folks. I do not need to speak on this issue, and I definitely should not speak at the very end in a way that's going to make it impossible for the group to continue on the pathway to unity. One more point, and I'll take the questions. I was talking about the role of the pastor in this, and pastors can really abuse their leadership role at this point. They are the weightiest of the weighty, right? I mean, they've been called to leadership in the church, and they know a whole lot about people. And sometimes clerks make the mistake of letting them think that they're not supposed to speak in business meetings. They are members, for goodness sakes. And their input should be welcomed all along, so they don't have that uncomfortable position of feeling like it's not really going in the right direction. And do they bring that up at the end? They should not bring it up at the end. And they should do it with a sense of humility, and they should say, you know, I'm pastor here, and I'm, you know, concerned about this question, but I don't want my voice to prevail over others. Here's what I'm thinking, though, at this time. And here's a part of the discussion that I think we haven't really attended to yet. And I appreciate being heard. And the clerk would thank them, but not go on as though they had veto power. So you can have no power or veto power, and neither one is as it should be. And that'd be true for a weighty friend or a pastor. Ron, you had a question. Yeah, that's unfortunate. I think a clerk can give a speech now and then to say at the front end of an issue where they know there's going to be a range of opinions and it's going to take a while to deal with it. They might give a speech something like this. You know, friends, I can expect that we have a variety of leadings on this. Our goal is to come to unity. This may take us a while. What I'm going to ask you is that from the beginning, you ask your questions and make your point. Please do not wait until the end, because we're in a process and we will come to the point where we will converge, and we want to be sure we're in unity. And if you wait until then to make your points, it's really hard. We want to hear you, but do it in a timely way. There was a question over here somewhere. Yeah. You want to be able to control the action, right?
No. I also don't want to be controlled by people who might want to stop
Oh, no. Anybody from Moscaloosa meeting here, be listening, taking notes. Yes. In your meeting, do they? Yeah. So how many months do you want to be pastor? In your meeting, do the elders essentially have the strongest voice on issues of worship and the tools of worship, or is it another group?
I'm not sure. There's a lot of strong voices from all over.
Oh, and people wouldn't defer to the elders on a question like this? No, okay. I think it's time to start with some empowering of the elders. I know there are different ways of doing it, and there may be a worship committee that actually has been given responsibility for things. In some meetings, they're completely comfortable with leaving the particulars up to the pastors with guidance from the elders. But I would think my preference would be that it be worked with, labored with in the elders. So you're not in the uncomfortable position of the elders just saying, oh, whatever, just bring it, just do it. I mean, they're leaving you out to suffer, and that's not right. They have to stand by you. They're the ones that have initiated the call, and you have to be able to say, folks, let me explain why I want us to explore this issue. And if we can come to unity, then I think there's hope that the rest of the meeting can support us in it. And if you assume, which I would in any place, that things like that would bring up concerns and dissenting voices, then start with a core group who really grasps your heart, that it clearly is not, how can we spend some of our money? Or how can we confuse people? And what do we do about the folks who say, well, this projector never works when we want to put something up, and they're just, oh, I hate that stuff. So I think the elders really have responsibility to step up and to look at what's underneath the presenting question. It's not about technology and being with it and trying to impress the younger people in the meeting, but it is saying, how can we get whether it's the words to the song or the announcement, so you don't have to read off every announcement, or the other things visually. And think about the people who have hearing impairments. My wife has, at the moment, terrible hearing. And she's waiting for surgery, but boy, she would not, if she couldn't see some of the things, even having them announced, she wouldn't know what's going on. And it's helped me to be more sensitive to that aspect of it. But plan to have some extended time with the elders and start with the foundation of what is worship? Worship 101. And what role does music play, and what role do having, you know, if you're in your messages, you'd like to have the text that you're discussing visually up there for all the same reasons, then say that you think it would strengthen our attentiveness to the Word of God, to have it more than just audio. Yes?
I guess I'm trying to find a balance of being a friend pastor and talking with different committees and groups, and in a way that's not, it doesn't seem like, oh, you need to talk to this committee. And then they say, oh, no, you need to talk to that committee. Oh, no, you need to talk to this committee. And you just
Yeah.
Yet people referring you to each other, you don't get to feel like you have that open conversation with everybody involved. And, I don't know. I'm just still trying to figure out how that
yeah. works. Oh, it's a horrible learning curve for a new pastor. I hear you. We had a meeting of the clerks of our committees to do some basic going through the faith and practice on the role of their committee, how when they're not quite sure what they're to be doing, where do they turn for guidance, and if we do things differently than the faith and practice says, how have we documented that, and how is it clear so that when those definitions have been achieved, there didn't have to be that wondering. And if the pastor, I think the pastor can be an ad hoc ex officio member of every committee if they want to. I can't imagine why. They'd be spending every night on committee meetings. But no, I think that part of that understanding should be, my understanding of my role as pastor is to be a helper, a servant, a leader, a guide, and bring things to you. So I'm not bypassing you to bring things on my own and say, folks, this is what we're going to do. And I'm going, oh, I thought that was our committee's job. Don't let yourself get caught with that kind of stuff. But have an open door policy in terms of individuals coming to you and saying, I'm really bothered by something you did. Oh, I'm sorry. Let's try to figure out what happened. And I have no desire to step on toes. My goal is for the strengthening of God's work in this group. And when I do something out of line, tell me, please, because it's going to happen. But I think this whole role of pastor, clerk, meeting is just a tough one. And frankly, I don't think we did enough with it in our book on that. Pastors can feel frustrated with having no power. And no one who would say, Pastor, what do you think? You know, a seminary degree isn't going to give somebody the final answer on everything, but they need to be heard. Otherwise, there are a lot of other denominations that are looking for pastors. Yes, Mac. There are people like that? I thought it was only in Northwest yearly meeting. Well, let me, I didn't really address section B on point six on this last page. And it is the legitimizer of the reservations that a person has who has been heard. And they are not saying, I want to stop action. Hopefully they're not. But standing aside is the usual phrase for that. And what I say is here, the clerk can say, would you be okay with changing the wording a little bit and saying that you're not able to unite with our action at this time? So it takes into account the possibility that down the line they may say, well, come to think of it, that was a pretty good thing to do. And that, of course, means they have to be reasonable people, not just stubborn naysayers. But I do like the wording, not able to unite. And if you put that in a minute when it's there, it's just there, and they are not saying, do not do this. God has told me we're not to do this. They're saying, I'm just not there yet. You say, and I like it if you don't name names. And I hate it when people say, I want to stand aside and I want it to be recorded in a minute. Now, why is that? Why do they have to be able to go back and tell people, I was against that, you can go check the minutes. No, I don't like that. But to be able to say, there are some among us who are not able to unite with this action. We love them and appreciate their input, and we feel led to go forward. If you work with the wording somewhat, you can hopefully begin to get the message through to them that we do care about what they have to say, but they cannot routinely be obstructionist. I mean, they can. They think they can because our system lends itself to it. But we must not immobilize ourselves by giving them excessive power and just letting them kind of horribly to gloat about what they just did. They just single-handedly stopped our action. And that's not anything to be proud of. So, pastors in the room, wouldn't hurt for you to do some preaching on unity now and then. Unity in the body of Christ. The texts are so rich. There's so many things that you could work with. And this thing of finding the mind of the Lord on action is at the heart of Christian unity. And it is not. Unity is not all being of the same mind. It is love that keeps us together and says, oh man, this carpet, round carpet, how could they have done that? We just say, you know what, it doesn't matter. When we get to heaven, they're going to have carpet of gold. And this stuff won't matter at all. It just doesn't matter. It's the holy I don't care. Now, the I don't care that really says I do care and I'm just feeling not hurt. I don't like that. But the I don't care was a Ford or a Chev, they'll both go down the road. It's all right. So, the stubborn voices can so tie us up in knots. And we need to be delivered from that. Let me see if there are...
Do you have one more question?
Ask all that you're allowed to ask. Yeah. Oh, what were the others? Oh. I think there are issues of gifting. Are gifts inherited? Absolutely not. Gifts are given by the Holy Spirit, and particular gifts lend themselves to the work of a clerk. We have a whole section we do at the Institute on the correlation of spiritual gifts with group discernment. And it's not just about what spiritual gifts the clerk should have, but how people with particular gifts in the meeting need to be released to share, bring those gifts to the discussion, and how you sometimes call on the person, you know they have the gift of mercy, and they will be particularly good at speaking to this question. No, I don't think clerks are born. Sometimes we think of it as, well, I'll probably have to do it sooner or later, so I might as well get it over with. I was clerk of our year meeting for 6 years, and I think I can get by with never being clerk of our year meeting again. But now I'm clerk of our monthly meeting, and I don't know how long I'll have to do that. This is much more fun to be out there than up here in a meeting for business. But I think being attentive to giftedness is a much broader issue for elders especially, saying, are we understanding people's gifts and matching them up with our calling? And in some cases, that is the calling to be in leadership as a clerk, or some people sitting in our meeting are actually called to pastoral ministry, and they've not fully understood that gift, and we are to go be with them and begin to draw that out of them. So, great opportunity. Well, we have, 3 minutes left, and let me see if I think we talked about that one. We talked about that one. We talked about that one. Okay, good.
I've heard the term gets back to court planning. Do you see a clerk as more of a leader or a servant?
Yes. I think the distortion of the concept of servanthood would be the weak clerk who somehow has it in their head that they They can only follow. If someone wants to speak, they have to call on them. You don't have to call on them. If there are people that want to keep talking, but they're really saying the same thing, you're not allowed to say, "Folks, I think we've heard really important points here, and we've repeated some of those points. Let's see if we're ready to move toward action." That's being a leader. The servant, the distorted servanthood idea would be just that. No, in our system, if someone wants to speak, you have to recognize them. No, you don't have to recognize them. And I don't think you can separate leadership from servanthood. I don't think there's a good pastor walking the face of the earth who isn't both leader and servant. It's not a good clerk who isn't both of those things. Colin is a great leader of FUM, but he is servant of general board, of a whole lot of other bodies, and sometimes they let him know that. but servanthood has at its heart the humility that says, "God has given me gifts that I'm called to exercise. I cannot gloat about that because they are gifts of God. They're not of my doing. So when I'm to exercise gifts of leadership, I'm to do it." Not saying, "Oh, no, I don't, you know." Got to be humble. So finding that blend, that tension between leadership and servanthood is really great. And so we've come to the end of our time. We have some great presentations ahead of us. Thank you for letting me come all the way from Oregon, home of the now defeated Oregon Ducks. Why'd I have to say that?